Welcome to the second episode commentary, where I share some of the behind the story ideas, writing intentions, and background information about this Star Trek Voyager audio drama. If you'd like to send me any feedback, good or bad, I'll not only reply, but also I'll read it out on the podcast. It's my want to have a conversation between us. The email is in the show notes, and this podcast will be copied onto my other podcast, Star Trek Reverie, also in the show notes. So, episode 2, In Uliam Rem Ni Propemus, part 1, or in English, Let's Not Rush Into Anything, part 1. The Latin title is taken from a line spoken by Henry Burleigh to Lucille Davenport, played by Janeway in her Hollow novel, from the episode Learning Curve. I wanted the opening to the second episode to set the scene, to show how quiet the ship was after the Delta dinner ended. In my mind, the ship was asleep, and I had a mental picture of the Sulaco from Aliens before the crew wakes up from hypersleep. Both the Sulaco crew and Voyager crew are waking up with a hangover of sorts, which then contrasts well with the more lively parts of the ship, giving Chell something more to do on the ship, but also bounce the negativity from the crew against how he feels. He isn't upset, of course, and his personality, as the story says, brings people to him and raises their spirits. I also wanted a time jump, so it's about 8 to 10 hours ahead, and we can skip over how the ship is commanded now by Admiral Patterson. I don't know what listeners were thinking at this stage because of the amount of Chell in the story, but I knew I wanted him as a secondary character I could play with and make my own. I don't have to have him conform to as many episodes as our titular heroes with the way we'd expect them to act. Writing Chell and the other Maquis made writing episodes 2 and 3 much easier in order to move my story along. There's a reference in the opening scene to McCoy from TOS Trek, when at the end of Star Trek 4 he says the bureaucratic mentality is the one constant in the galaxy. And I figured, after 7 years, some of the Maquis are disappointed with their circumstances when the Federation bureaucracy decides to remove them from Starfleet. This was a chance to add a dimension to a third of the crew running around in the background from the show. It's entirely plausible some of them would want to stay on in Starfleet while some don't. More about this in the next episode. And rather than just mention the Equinox crew as an Easter egg, I used them as a yardstick to say things could have been worse for the Maquis, and whatever they are going through is less than what others are going through. In Chapter 2, we get a dialogue-heavy scene that reintroduces 4 of our well-known characters. I really wanted Harry to feel pressure with his new position, B'Elanna to be upset, but mentally quick on her feet, and have her one step ahead of Tom, and you can see that when he's forgotten how B'Elanna was previously in the Maquis. And actually, there's a through line even up till Episode 5, where B'Elanna has something on her mind that Tom doesn't know, which will obviously be revealed in a later episode. But I'm setting it up here in this very first chapter. Then Chakotay arrives, and he's really taking everything in his stride, as others have already said. And he's relieved, in fact, when he's been told he's not in command of Voyager anymore. And you can see that because he cares more about his people, including morale. I'd like to think it's a layered and uncomplicated scene, but it does allow a catch-up since Tom and BLT were asleep through these events, and those events can be relayed to them and then to you as well. Could someone have woken them up while they were sleeping? Yes, but I figure B'Elanna's friends wanted her to rest. That was more important. As we move into listening to Chapter 3, we find that Q is defending Catherine. I thought it would be an interesting idea. Starfleet Command couldn't ever stop Q if he ever makes a decision against them. So what would they do if they disagreed with him, with regards to Janeway's court-martial? What is Janeway's dreams? What is Janeway's dreams like if Q is looking after her? Is she on a subconscious level seeking his help? In the earliest version of this scene, which did make it to the podcast, I had Tuvok suffering from the Fal Torvo, and messed up because the medical procedure is the Fal Torvo. The actual issue with his brain didn't have a name in Endgame, it's just a neurodegenerative disease. Difficult enough to say here, never mind practice it properly in the episode, so that took a lot of work to get right with regards to pronunciation. So we have this scene where Tuvok is visiting Janeway, as Chakotay alluded to, and I've always liked Tuvok's dry sense of humour in the series, hence his remark about Lieutenant Kim being the one to hold everything together, because He's leaving the ship. Catherine's going, and Chakotay is not in charge. I'm trying to mirror the moment where he suggested flogging crew members to Janeway in the episode where they are being experimented on, and Janeway is upset that Tom and B'Elanna are seen kissing. And I tried to keep as many mannerisms as possible as well for Tuvok. This seemed to me like a good attempt. Also in this scene, you get a battle of wills. Even though Janeway is upset, she's not willing to deny Tuvok a chance to get home. She's still keeping her promise. And ultimately, emotions defeat logic. This scene also tells us what's on Starfleet's mind, in a sense. There are 32 charges against Captain Janeway, and this isn't a made-up figure. I found a mock court trial written from 20 years ago on the internet, explaining everything Janeway had been accused of. The entire thing is 10,000 words that I will adapt into Janeway's court-martial storyline. So credit will be given where credit is due. I managed to get in contact with one of the writers who said he'd answer any questions I might have, which is nice. But imagine for a second writing some fan fiction that you might consider to be thrown away from around the year 2001, 2002. And then 20 years later, somebody wants to adapt it into their audio drama. It's kind of a strange blast from the past. The trial of Janeway, however, won't begin until next year at any rate. My hope is that because the words are already written, I can also bang out those episodes much more quickly. And as extra insight, I'm also reading David Mack's Collateral Damage book for insight into how to write a trial. In his story, Picard takes the stand because he's supposedly a traitor to the Federation. He's messed up with some shenanigans with Section 31 and Admiral Ross. I won't spoil it if you're interested, but interestingly, the story picks up a character from A Measure of a Man, who is Captain Philippa Louvois. Louvois? Louvois? You know what I mean. It's French. In Chapter 4, we have our classic Star Trek log, and it's the first one from Harry's perspective as a lieutenant. There will be a lull in logs as the stories calm down, and our heroes are for the most part out of Starfleet. And then hopefully I'll bring them back. I tried to write this chapter as a Tom and Harry chapter, with Tom coming out on top. And he's coming out on top against Admiral Patterson. It's my hope that it's obvious Patterson is also mistrustful of Tom because he knew him as a child, whereas Mitchell, Admiral Mitchell, is trusting of him because he doesn't know him. And there's a odd switch, because usually people that you don't know, you don't trust until you do get to know them. So I'm trying to layer in that aspect to these relationships. Patterson is seen as knowing Tom Paris from the episode Relativity, where Seven is going back in time to save Voyager from Captain Braxton. So what we have is there's an opposite attraction going on between the two men with Tom. I'm also planning to create a character from one of the pilots that Tom and Harry fought against, but that's further down the line. I've mentioned Varric a few times in this two-parter, only to suggest other characters we know are still doing something, and it's to let you know I haven't forgotten about them. I think it fills out the ship, and doesn't cost anything, obviously, to include them, unlike with the TV series. And did anybody catch the call back to Caretaker, where Tom doesn't know what to say? Here he says in this scene, it's the second time where he doesn't know what to say. In keeping with Patterson's version of being friendly, he also changes Tom's name, like he does with Janeway's. And of course he can't change Harry's name, because his name already has a letter Y, whereas Tom is Tommy and Catherine is Kathy. In Memory Beta canon, by the way, Patterson's first name is Theoderic, so I just kept it from there and used it. Chapter 5 is an effort to break up the long scene of the Admirals and Tom and Harry getting on board the flyer and flying around. And I also wanted you to know the Doctor has nothing to do, and further this mention of Starfleet Medical not being interested in him. But Barclay has a use for him beyond friendship. And as a subtle nod to the character of Barclay, I intend to not write him with a stutter in front of the Doctor. And that's because Lieutenant Barclay is always more comfortable around holographic characters. Chapter 6. This episode is a way to bring Mitchell further into the story, and we learn more about him, his role in the Dominion War, and that he was a pilot like Tom. We also get another partnership from Harry and Tom, and probably the last one between them for a while. And in a manner that I think befits Theoderic Patterson, he surprises Tom and Harry with a war game scenario. This chapter was going to be a lot more boring, but my editor at the time suggested we take the fire out of the ship rather than just discuss the ship in that cargo bay. It's a great idea, it's a great opportunity to show instead of tell, and that's the value of getting the right feedback. And I couldn't believe I didn't see that idea at first. It seems obvious in retrospect. But it answers the question, just how good is the Flyer in the Alpha Quadrant? We get our first ship battle and comparison. The Flyer can outfly a Runabout and a Peregrine, both ships which we've seen from DS9. I used the Yellowstone designation to suggest Runabouts have moved on from the Danu class, so even though they are improved, they are still not a match for the Flyer. The Yellowstone was mentioned in the episode Non Sequitur from Season 2 of Voyager. And while the Admiral is testing the Flyer, he wanted to see how Tom would perform. In a way, he's testing him. And in his eyes, Tom has indeed changed. So yay for Tom, I guess. Chapter 7. The portable regenerators are a reference to the 1-7 built for Icheb when we went to his homeworld in the episode Child's Play. Over time, it made sense 7 could make an even better version. And here in the scene, 7 is able to focus on the short term, whereas Icheb is going full steam ahead into the academy and looking at his career from the long term. And as some subtext, 7 has baggage, mental baggage, while creating more baggage for them both by recreating the portable regenerators. That's the idea anyway. 7 might be happy with various short-term projects now that she's back. I'm sorry for the drilling. It's so strange. Before I started recording, there was silence, and I'm not stopping now, so I've tried to minimize it as much as possible. Chapter 8. It's here we expand on the Maquis crew members to be used as characters for this audio drama. We get a snippet of what they've done over the 7 years, with Maria Henley being disappointed with being kicked out of Starfleet. I'd assume she worked hard ever since her first episode debut with Learning Curve. And with Dalby only being concerned about eating and not caring about much of anything, he's probably coasted ever since that episode as well. Again, while it's a catch-up, these characters will serve the story later on. So this scene is a setup for many things going forward. I really wanted Tal Sellers from the episode Good Shepherd to also appear, but I couldn't find a way to do it. The point was to collect different members of the crew we've seen over the years and put them into a new group, like in TNG Lower Decks style. But I don't think I need to explain where everybody comes from. Tabor, another character that we've seen, is on the communicator, and while he was a part of the Maquis, he seemed to be one of the ones who weren't a problem from the end of Season 1 in Learning Curve. Personally, I don't like having two Bajoran male characters, that's Tabor and Geren, but it does strengthen the case for my story that everybody in this scene would eventually decide to travel to Bajor. And since I want to include Deep Space Nine, it works in my favour anyway. Both men would be the anchor for the rest of the group, as Dalby wanted to look after Geren, and still wants to. Jor is romantically linked to Tabor, so Maria doesn't want to be the odd one out. Therefore, that's our second group of characters. If Voyager had reused Geren from Learning Curve going into the episode Repression, that would have been a neat touch, but it seemed they only wanted Chell to be a continuing character. How could they pass up on not using Dalby again? I love his ability to fly off the handle, and it still cracks me up when they first meet him. He's so happy when he's trying to fix the neural gel pack, and then when he gets the slightest pushback from Tuvok, he flips. Then in the other scene when they're playing pool and he explains his tragic backstory, it's just from left field. It's amazing. And with Chell, ever since he took the kitchen off Neelix, I think in real time about 2 or 3 months prior, I'd like to think Dalby manipulates Chell for better food while he's in charge of the galley. Dalby is almost meme material, or potentially the polar opposite of Barclay in terms of speaking up for himself. Anyway, I'll get a chance to mention Jor as well, so we've got our next set of characters, the beginning of their own perspectives, and let's not forget the Wildwin family. The backstory, the planet name drops I mentioned, mostly come from Beta Canon, as does all of Henley's background information. Anyway, their dynamics are now at play here in my story. Chapter 9, the penultimate chapter almost. The door buzzer is the focal point of the entire scene. It reminds me of a TNG episode that I can't properly remember, so I can't name drop it, but it's where everybody is disturbing Captain Picard, and I wanted the sound effects of the door buzzer to play a part in being annoying, not just to Janeway, but maybe to you as well. One of the first few guests is Admiral Owen. He arrives, and he honestly didn't know Janeway was going to be court-martialed. Starfleet commanders nice like that. They don't want to put all the admirals in uncomfortable positions. Of course, Janeway feels like a fool once the news comes after the celebrations. This kind of bureaucracy always reminds me of our everyday relationships, where we use people for a purpose until necessary, or people think giving bad news after fun times is the best time to do so. I remember an old ex-girlfriend spending the day with me, and only at the end did she want to break up. I'd rather she just break up with me at the beginning of the day, and I could have done something else with my day. It's wrong to lead people on if you know you're going to end something or deliver bad news. But if Janeway found out immediately, would she have left the ship before flying over San Francisco? That would have been an interesting thing because it would be Tuvok or Harry in charge, or Admiral Patterson, actually, for that matter, and in Endgame, and it would have added an extra layer of misery to the event as she's watching the Starship Voyager fly over the celebrations in San Francisco. And with Admiral Owen's arrival, we get another info dump about the state of Starfleet post-war. And the post-war aspects are going to play a huge factor into this story. I mean, we're going to have a Voyager Deep Space Nine crossover at some point anyway. For the moment, Owen Paris looks at the USS Sovereign sitting out of the window. To me, the Sovereign-class starship always represented a shift in Starfleet policy, going from beautiful cruiser, family-friendly galaxy-class ships to Sovereigns with no families on board and armed more to the teeth. I would say that's a natural evolution from the Defiant because of the Borg, and another reaction from taking the Federation away from a near-death experience against the Dominion. These newer ships have no families on board, but somehow need to maintain a friendly, quasi-military nature to them. It's a neat balancing act, and one that the Voyager crew's mindset is interfering with. And Owen is right. What would happen if Janeway didn't arrive back so quickly, and some of what Janeway had done has faded? Is the Federation too protective of their captain's actions? I'd like to think this links in with Benjamin Maxwell's remark about the bureaucrats back at Starfleet Command. It's all a tease in any case. We certainly want to find out more about the captain's circumstances. How does she get to be an admiral in 18 months' time when we see her in Star Trek Nemesis? But at this point in the story, I wanted to get rid of Janeway, to concentrate on the other heroes, because she's such a larger-than-life character, and I can't deal with all of her consequences in the beginning. That's why the preceding episodes after episode 3 are dedicated to specific characters other than Janeway. In my mind, I'm treating Endgame as a part 1 for Captain Janeway, Caretaken as part 2, and this episode as a part 3 for her story, because everything is so Janeway focused. Now with Kathryn gone, she's breaking the idea of the captain having to go down with her ship, but her ship isn't going down, so it's fine for her to leave the ship. And as she's walking to the transporter bay, we get this flashback or this sense of frustration. And I'm making a commentary on the fact of that the ship is so modern that it can't react. You can't imbue the ship with any emotional resonance of yourself. That's why, ironically, the holographic Burleigh House can represent a person more, with the creaking doors, creaking floors, slamming of the doors, all those things that a door takes on our character with. And also, it links back to the title of the episode and is another reference to Henry Burleigh and Janeway's horror novel, because it was seen as an escape from real life while she's running the ship. Here at the end, I mentioned that Varric is now running the transporter room as well. In my headcanon, he's doing all sorts of odd jobs as crew members are leaving the ship, leaving him to do all the little jobs. But it's handy because he's leaving with Tuvok anyway. And here we also get Mr. Ayala, another Maquis member, and I hope you remember him. He was Chakotay's number 2 in their terrorist days. But I'll explain more about him in part 2 of In Ulliam Rem Ni Propemus, Let's Not Rush Into Anything, part 2. I hope I didn't butcher the Latin. Thank you for listening.